This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
This is Recode Media, Peter Kafka. That is me. Whenever I'm really enjoying a TV show, I watch the TV show, obviously, but then I seek out Joanna Robinson from The Ringer because she writes and podcasts about this stuff better than anyone else. She's my favorite. But Joanna is not just a TV person. She also loves herself some movies. She also loves Marvel movies in particular, which is my long windup to say Joanna Robinson has co-written a new book. It's called MCU, The Reign of Marvel Studios. Welcome back, Joanna.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having me. I love talking to you about dragons and superheroes and sort of drag you down into the genre dirt with me, Peter.
I don't like the implication that I'm above the genre dirt. I love genre stuff, but I am often confused by it, which is the way in particular I wanted to talk to you about Marvel, because we talk a lot about the business of Marvel and the business of Disney, and occasionally I think I tend to sort of forget why people like the stuff. And I wanted to talk to you about that. But tell me what the book is supposed to be. Is it for hardcore Marvel fans or people who don't spend a lot of time thinking about Marvel? Is it for businessy people?
This is the question I was asking the entire time we were writing the book. I was having this sort of identity crisis of who is this book for? Is constantly what I was asking my co-authors. And eventually what we decided, maybe for our own peace of mind, was that it's for everyone. I know that sounds like a really slick sales tactic, but I really do think, so there's definitely juicy tidbits in here for people who think they already know everything about Marvel. I've heard that from a number of people who thought they knew everything about Marvel on their own. There was so much in here I didn't know. So you love to hear that when you're an author. So check on that department. If you are a Marvel skeptic, if you think Marvel is ruining Hollywood, if you think Marvel is having a big stumble in 2023 and you're curious as to why, I think there's a lot of stuff in there for how did they take over this industry? Like a film industry book. There's definitely business for the business minded. There's definitely a business book in there because we've got chapters on their collaboration with China and how that impacts the global box office. Or we've got the long-running battle between New York Marvel Entertainment and West Coast Marvel Studios. And then for people who don't know anything at all, it really is like a soup to nuts sort of examination of the whole phenomena. So I really do like to think there's something for everyone. And what helps me sell that at the end of the day is the fact that, you know, I wrote this with two other people, Dave Gonzalez, Gavin Edwards. Gavin is a very seasoned writer. And when we put all the pieces together, I did all the interviews, Dave did a lot of the research, we all wrote it together, but Gavin gave it this really lively, page-turnery like tone that I've heard from a ton of people. They just zipped through the book, that it was fun for them to read, which again, you love to hear it as an author. Many people are saying, Peter, that this book is quite fun.
Many people are saying.
And it's for everyone. So what more could you want in a book, honestly?
All right. We'll just end the podcast there. Go buy the book.
Done.
Make Joanna happy. We are talking roughly, though, just to put this in context, this is sort of the era in movie making that kicks off with Iron Man, which was made before Marvel was acquired by Disney. And then obviously Disney acquires Marvel and then changes culture, changes the movie business.
Remind us.
These people did not make the first superhero movies. They didn't even make the first modern superhero movies.
Right.
Why is Marvel such a big deal in modern movie making?
There's a couple elements at play here. Iron Man, 2008's Iron Man, is not even the first Marvel superhero movie, right? You have great films like Blade. That's a Marvel movie that Marvel Studios didn't exist to make. You've got less well-received movies like Ben Affleck's Daredevil or the spinoff Elektra. You know, you've got the X-Men at Fox. You've got Spider-Man at Sony. All of that predates Marvel Studios existing. But at a certain point, and believe it or not, it all happened at Mar-a-Lago, there was a conversation between someone named David Maisel and someone named Ike Perlmutter, who's the head of Marvel Entertainment at the time, the whole Marvel at the time, saying, hey, what if we made our own movies, right? What if we form our own studio and instead of licensing out our characters to other people to either make more money than we're making off of our own characters or fumbling in a way that it sort of damages the brand. Why don't we take control, take all the money? Let's do that. So a comic book company being their own studio is something that's like somewhat replicated with DC over at Warner Brothers, but not quite in the same way. And then that interconnected universe is, of course, Marvel's calling card into the world of franchising, that they say, okay, what if we make Iron Man and we're going to make Robert Downey Jr. is Iron Man, Edward Norton is the Hulk, but guess what? They're going to be related. And then there's going to be a Thor movie and a Captain America movie. Then we're going to make Avengers. And it all becomes sort of must-see TV to steal from NBC in the 90s. And you have to watch everything. And then it becomes this sort of interconnected, can't miss a single installment, ongoing soap opera to a certain extent.
So that interconnected is that really ramps up after Bob Iger has bought Marvel and then really juices it up, right?
Well, I mean, the Avengers as a concept existed before Disney.
Right, right. This was sort of in motion, but it wasn't going to happen without Disney's clout and
it definitely would not have been as successful without Disney as like a distributing partner and then as the full muscle backing them, for sure.
So my question is, why does Marvel matter? And it matter, and you sort of get to, well, all the stories are interconnected and that matters. And I've heard people say that for many years, and I understand it. But I also, I'm always feel a little unsatisfied with that answer because I know there is a subset of moviegoers who are also big comics fans and Marvel's fans who understand the connections and the characters and also what's in the movie versus what's in, you know, issue 68 of whatever the comic series is. And I've seen a lot of the movies, but I like comics, but I'm not that person. I can't imagine them looking around the theater that the majority of people in the theater are those hardcore fans who know all the stories. And so I'm still sort of unsatisfied about why these things took off in a way that other comics movies didn't. Is it just that there is enough of those fans that guarantee sort of a base level success for all the movies? Or did they tap into something? I mean, I remember taking people who are older than me to see the last two Avengers movies, right?
Yeah. So,
and they definitely had not watched the 16 prior to that.
Sure.
And they could follow along. They got the general idea of what was happening. So why did it work for so many people?
Yeah, I think the key figure throughout all of this, the soup to nuts Marvel stories, is Kevin Feige, head of Marvel Studios. And something that, you know, we really get into in the book is this concept of Kevin not being a comic book guy. He did not grow up collecting comics deep into the comic book world. He's a blockbuster cinema guy. He grew up, he loved Richard Donner's Superman movie, right? But because it was a big sort of blockbuster, he loved Back to the Future. He loves all things Spielberg. Like, that's who he was growing up.
There's the kind of movies that Hollywood made. Right. All the time. But they weren't necessarily connected to IP. Some of them were, but some of them weren't.
Exactly. And so basically what he does is he like kind of skins these Marvel movies. They're secretly just these late 70s, 80s, early 90s blockbusters that he grew up loving. There's some apocryphal story about him skipping his prom to go line up for Back to the Future or something like that. You know, like, that's who Kevin Feige was. And once he got involved in Marvel at a sort of lower sort of assistant level, he goes to work for Richard Donner, who made Superman, Lauren Shuler Donner. He goes in through that door into this world. He studies and he learns comic books and now he knows them better than almost anyone else, but that's not how he grew up. And so what that allows him to do, I believe, is make a film that is friendly to you or people who are even more casual than you are when it comes to comic book knowledge, because he's not looking at it from like too deep inside the culture. He's looking at it from the outside, from like a blockbuster point of view, from a character point of view. And I think that's a real key thing for Marvel. You care in their best examples. You care, you get emotionally invested in the likes of Steve Rogers or Tony Stark or Natasha or Clint or all these characters. And it sets the story apart from some of these other stories that wind up just being CGI soup at the end of the day, because you don't have a human or human-esque character to emotionally latch onto.
So is Kevin Feige more important than the Marvel IP itself? Because one of the stories about Marvel, right, is that a lot of these, which became huge, huge movie characters, right, were not major comic book characters. A lot of them are subsidiary characters.
Yeah, they had sold off, you know, I mentioned earlier that Fox had X-Men and Sony had Spider-Man, you know, back in the earlier days of Marvel Comics when they're trying to dig out of bankruptcy in the 90s, they start licensing their characters off to all these other studios. And that means when Marvel Studios itself, after this luncheon at Mar-a-Lago, after when they start to establish their studios, they have what all the headlines screamed at the time, like the B-list heroes, like Iron Man. Everyone's like, who's ever heard of Iron Man?
Thor,
at the time,
right?
You know, Thor, Captain America. Who are these? Captain America's a silly Boy Scout with, you know, wings on his helmet. You know, Thor is this weird Shakespearean Norse god. And Tony Stark in the comics was a sort of alcoholic, abusive, you know, just strange character necessarily to latch onto. But a reason they started with Tony Stark, not just because they didn't have every single character in their arsenal to start with, but they tested these characters with kids, and the kids loved the Iron Man toy. They loved that. So from a toy making point of view, which is a big part of Ike Perlmutter and his legacy at Marvel, they were like, this is a hit. Iron Man's going to be a hit because the kids love that action figure.
And that was the old way of thinking about those blockbuster movies that definitely I remember from being a kid, right? You went and saw Star Wars, and then you, or really your parents, spent several mortgages acquiring toys connected yeah. to that. And that was, and I worked at a toy store for a while, and the idea was the toy rollout always accompanied the movie, and that was sort of where the if the people were smart, that's where they were really going to cash in.
Yeah, and for a while, Marvel Comics was really content to make that their profit from these other movies that they had farmed out to other people. So Fox casts Hugh Jackman as Wolverine, makes all these X-Men movies, and they say, okay, well, we get all the toy sales. Or if you think back to the 90s, this is my entry was sort of X-Men the Animated Series, which was a big deal in the 90s. The plot lines of those stories were dictated by what toys they wanted to make,
right.
You know, in conjunction. That's classic Saturday morning cartoon logic. But I think that definitely bleeds into at least early MCU is that toyetic, toy-minded approach to storytelling.
Toyetic is an awesome word. I'm going to use that again. So Kevin Feige is instrumental to Disney and Marvel's success in the movies. Again, like we've said, there's other people who've got access to movie characters and try to cartoon superhero characters, superheroes, and turn them into movies with varying degrees of success. None of them nearly as successful as Marvel. And I'm not original to point this out. DC has, now owned by Discovery Warner Brothers, mm-hmm. has, you know, better known characters, obviously Batman and Superman. And they, for a while, they were trying to sort of fashion those characters into their version of the DCU.
Yeah.
Why did that not work compared to Marvel?
So I think the moment that, you know, Christopher Nolan is making these incredibly successful Batman movies.
They're standalone that just, there's just Batman and related
just Batman
characters.
Changes the way that, you know, the Oscar Best Picture category works, like seismic for the culture. That's the environment that Marvel is launching. You know, so they're sort of running to catch up to Nolan and what he's doing over Warner Brothers with like how important culturally a superhero story can be. So they start chasing that a little bit. But something that Feige and you know, he would say he would not take the credit by himself. So I want to be careful with that. There's a lot mm-hmm. of other people at Marvel doing making great moves. But he likes to talk about, first of all, he's very diplomatic, so he would never say that anyone else had failed. That's not something that he would ever say on the record. But he would say, walk before you run. And when you look at early Marvel, like we said, you get an Iron Man movie, a Hulk movie, you get another Iron Man movie, you get a Captain America movie, you get a Thor movie, then you get Avengers. Zack Snyder, for all his great virtues and all his myriad potential sins, like he started with Man of Steel, Henry Cavill is Superman. He wanted to make another Superman movie. And they said, no, let's bring Batman. Let's go. Let's go. We got to catch up to Marvel. Now Marvel has outpaced us. And
let's
so
hit the
DC
gas.
Starts,
we got to accelerate. Yeah, we have to do what they're doing.
We have to get to Justice League first. We're not going to bother introducing The Flash to you first. We're not going to bother Aquaman, Cyborg, all these characters. They're just going to be there and everyone will catch up. And it was just sort of a, I think they fumbled the ball on that franchise because of their desperation to catch up now to what Marvel was doing when Marvel did a slow and steady trickle at the beginning of their franchising. So I think that's, among other things, that's a big misstep that DC made.
Because the other thing you would hear is, well, DC is too serious and gray and grimy, and Marvel is intentionally more colorful and poppy and fun. I mean, it sort of makes sense to me. Although, on the other hand, they're still kind of all the same stuff to me. It's still men in tights doing, and then with CGI battles. Do you think the tone really matters or comes through, that difference?
I think the tone isn't nothing, but I think you can have something like the first Wonder Woman movie, which was a huge hit, and that has like a lightness of tone to it. So I don't think you're, without sort of being as maybe MCU bubbly as some of the Marvel and Disney installments. So I think you can definitely have the DC characters, and you can have a grittier, like DC's comics have always been grittier than Marvel comics. So you can have that grit without getting into, to quote Will Arnett as Lego Batman, like the darkness, no parents, yes, sort of like really, really dark side of DC, you know? And so tone matters, and definitely Marvel very intentionally, you know, Blade was kind of hard edge. Deadpool, who is a Marvel character over at Fox, that's, you know, that's for more adult audiences. And the MCU very intentionally said, let's try to hit all quadrants. Let's make it something kids and adults can watch together. Absolutely. That was on their plan. That's not even like necessarily a Disney mandate for Marvel. That was something that was on Marvel's mind, again, I think from a toyetic point of view, from the start when they made their movies.
We'll be right back after a word from a sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And we're back. Let's talk more about the Disneyification of this. We talk about Kevin Feige, how important he is to all this. Bob Iger, who has been the CEO of Disney for forever with a quick pit stop.
Yeah.
And now he's unretired himself. When he came on to run Disney, was not considered a creative executive. And now in the telling is considered a creative executive. He considers himself a creative executive. What kind of role did he have in shaping the overall Marvel universe and specific movies? Is he weighing in? Is he giving Kevin Feige notes about, you know, someone about dialogue or costumes?
In the book, what we've discovered through all the interviews that we did is that the main sort of given Kevin Feige notes, oppressive overlord type of role belonged to Ike Perlmutter, who was Marvel East Coast,
which again was originally the comic book company that he bought and then
sold. He's over on the East Coast. There's something called the Creative Committee that's formed out of Marvel Entertainment in New York. And once Iron Man's a smashola hit, and they understand that this is going to be a thing, then they form the Creative Committee, and there's a few members on the creative, one member in particular who sort of gets roasted, especially in our book, who start giving some increasingly ridiculous notes. And some of their comments are, two of my favorites, all-time favorites, are telling James Gunn that nobody wants a sort of 70s soundtrack to Guardians of the Galaxy. Nobody wants to listen to that music, right? And the soundtrack of Guardians of the Galaxy is one of its... fans love that thing.
Yeah.
It was a best-selling record. Or with Captain America Civil War, which is the movie where, if you recall, all the heroes are lined up facing each other on an airport tarmac and they go,
yes,
to battle. Marvel in New York says, who wants to watch heroes fight each other?
Everyone
in the world wants to write that. You know, so
have you ever been a kid? Of course you want Spider-Man to fight Batman. That's
the whole point.
You smash
your action figures, yes, together. That's what you do, Marvel East Coast. So that was the battle of control that dominated the first few phases of Marvel. And Iger was actually whether or not he likes to fancy himself a creative exec, what Iger's superpower is in this Marvel story, at least, is relationships, right? And managing relationships and sort of trying to make broker peace between East Coast, West Coast Marvel, and then eventually cut East Coast Marvel out and say, Kevin has made us conservatively a gajillion dollars. So guess what? Kevin gets to call the shots at Marvel. And when they first bought Marvel, their whole pitch to Marvel was, this is going to be like Pixar. We left Pixar alone creatively. We'll leave you alone creatively. Like, we want to help you, want to boost you. We don't want to control you. We're here to, we want to expand our brand beyond princesses. We want the, the young male market, and that's why they acquire Lucasfilm, Marvel, etc. But we will not strangle you creatively. That has never been Disney's role in all of this.
So even prior to the we can talk about whether it's a lull or a descent or whatever it is, whatever Marvel's going through now.
I call there it the, was the wobble.
The wobble. So yeah. Sort of see where you're headed there. But prior to that, there was still a pretty significant, at least loud group of people saying, hey, these Marvel movies that make a gazillion dollars, they're also the worst possible thing for art, for culture, for our industry. There's nothing wrong with comic book movies, but we can't only make comic book movies. And you love them, obviously, but you love all sorts of stuff. What do you make of that critique that they were sort of crowding out the cultural and business landscape?
Right. The Marty Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, et cetera, et cetera.
You're talking about, Martin Scorsese in particular had comments saying it's not real cinema. And I think that's a silly debate, but I'm certainly open to, there should be other things in theaters.
And I wholly agree. Like, to your point, I do love superhero cinema. I love the good ones, right? It's not everyone, but I love the good ones. And I love thinking about how this Marvel interconnected universe changed the way that we think about storytelling. It's kind of bringing television into the movie theater to be like, here's an episode, here's an episode, here's an episode you got to watch. So from I've studied Hollywood my whole life. This is a really interesting story to me, but I wholeheartedly agree. I miss the variety of cinema we used to get. And is that wholly Marvel's fault? I would not say so, because what it's reflective of is how cinema going has just changed, how people go to the movies less and less, how people stay at home and watch, on their big screen with their surround sound so they don't have to pay for a babysitter, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that people have been perseverating.
But it's all intertwined, right? They're making those Marvel movies because they know it's one of the few things that people
that'll
will
get
go
people
to see in a movie.
Get butts in seats, right? And so once the window narrows to we're only watching a couple movies a year, and then, we're only going to watch the Marvel movies because, A, you can't miss a single one. You got to watch them all. And B, it'll feel like our dollars are going somewhere because we can see them in the big, loud CGI booms, and that goes for other things as well. Oppenheimer, to bring a good example from this year, Dune, even though that came out during the pandemic, I was packed into an IMAX theater with my mask on to watch Dune, there are certain big spectacle things that you feel like you have to see in a cinema or you're not really seeing them. I think it's heartbreaking what has happened in our film going habits. I often talk about missing the monoculture. I miss when we were all watching not just superhero movies, but all kinds of movies that we all watched together and then we could all talk about and have the same shared cultural references. And I thought that was going to be forever when I was growing up. And it turns out that was just like a phase of our culture. And now we're in a different thing where, say, memes or, depressingly to me, memes or TikToks or some other things, that becomes the monoculture. So it's connected to Marvel, but it's not as if Marvel muscled out all these things in a sort of supervillain kind of way.
I mean, I guess the other thing I'd add to that is that Iger specifically, when he took over at Disney, said, we make all kinds of movies and we're going to stop doing that. We're only going to make giant tentpole movies. Many of them are going to be Marvel movies. Some will be Lucasfilm, but whatever they are, we're not taking risks on things people don't know about. And we're only going to try to make movies that only are considered successes if they're like $1 billion in box office.
Do you ever fire up an old movie and the Touchstone logo comes across the bottom, which was, Disney brand, and then you watch the movie and you're like, I cannot believe this was a Disney movie.
It was for adults.
Wild. Yeah, yeah.
Your term for what Marvel is in right now is the wobble. Mm-hmm. It's a bunch of different things going on at the same time, I think. So they were on this run with the Avengers, which ended right around the pandemic, right before the pandemic. Pandemic changes everything. They also launched Disney Plus, and so a lot of Marvel stuff starts showing up on TV for streaming. It's supposed to be connected to the MCU. And then eventually some of the Marvel movies come out after this, and some do okay by Marvel standards. Some are flops. A lot of them are critically reviled. Unpack sort of what's happening there. And are those just three random things happening at the same time, or are they all connected?
I think, unfortunately for Marvel, post-Endgame was a really critical moment for them because they lost some of their heavy hitters.
Their stars.
And
Robert Downey Jr., Chris Hemsworth. Those guys were all signed on for long deals, and now they're no longer
going to play Iron Man. Scarlett Johansson, Chris Evans, and Downey all decide to leave. Scarlett is one more movie, but like they're effectively exiting. That's the seniors graduating. That's the varsity team. They're moving on. And what had happened was Marvel had seeded a number of players in to sort of rise up and take their place. They knew that was coming. They were going to keep these people forever.
And part of the premise, the conventional wisdoms of modern stardom, right, is that Iron Man is more important than Robert Downey Jr. And
Evan
that's what
said
we don't
that.
Have stars now because it's the costumes.
Right. Evan said that in a recent GQ interview. He was like, yeah, Captain America is way more famous than Chris Evans is. Absolutely. And, you know, what was interesting about what Marvel did is they hired Downey, who was more notorious than he was famous at the time that they hired him. But they hired Downey. And then when they make Iron Man 2, Downey's like, okay, a lot more money, please. And they hired Edward Norton, who was had a lot of prestige coming off of like American History X. But he was a huge problem. He's like one of the most contentious relationships ever in Marvel's history is between Marvel and Edward Norton. And so after that happens, they're like, what if we hire these Chrises who aren't really anyone and we'll make them and we'll mold them into something, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when you get Evans and Hemsworth, et cetera. But the point being, they hire these other people like Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange, Paul Rudd as Ant-Man, and then really very crucially to their future, Chadwick Boseman in Black Panther, Brie Larson for Captain Marvel, Tom Holland
so far,
is their new Spider-Man, right? And like, that's the plan. And on paper, that seems like a great plan, right? They're like, we got this. They're going to leave. Here's the new stars. I don't think they saw what happened to Captain Marvel and Brie Larson coming in terms of this minority toxic fandom being so
spell that out,
because
I think a lot of people missed what happened.
Absolutely. Happy to spell it out. To be clear, Captain Marvel, the Brie Larson-fronted solo adventure, made over $1 billion. That is a successful film. But what is also true is that it got review bombed by a bunch of people who were upset that a woman was leading a superhero film. That
and we've seen those same trolls attack
Star Wars. Disney,
right, when they have got a non-white guy there, they freak out.
And so Brie herself has said in interviews that made her uncertain about her future with Marvel. She's like, why should I put up with this, essentially? You know, why would I want to do that? Chadwick Boseman passes away. That is tragic on a number of levels, and you know, low down on the list of tragedies is the fact that like Marvel's like, oh no, we had sort of considered him a linchpin of the franchise going forward. Doctor Strange lands, Ant-Man lands. It doesn't feel the same anymore. And so this is all 2019 is when Endgame comes out. To your point, COVID hits us all in 2020. So like Black Widow comes out and it's COVID. Eternals comes out, it's COVID. Yeah. Then the Disney Plus stuff, which Iger left Disney and a lot of people blamed the diminishment of the brand via the Disney Plus flooding on Bob Chapek, but it was Iger's plan before
that
he
was
left
his
Disney.
Thing.
That was
he
his
said,
whole
yeah,
thing.
We're gonna launch this new streaming service with Marvel stuff. We're gonna make a ton of it. Let's put that into motion. And then he walked away from
and
it.
Then
it's
he
all
walked
his
away.
Plan.
And then he came back and he was like, after he replaced his own replacement, he said like, oh, we need to focus on doing less and higher quality, as if he was not the
who
one
thought
who
this was a good idea,
opened
me.
The taps in the first place. Exactly. So, you know, I think that's been bigger even than the pandemic, is this idea that the Marvel Studios model, which throughout the book you can see them hone it and develop it, really relies, to our earlier conversation, on Feige as this central creative figure, this almost director producer over all of these stories. He can do that when they're putting two, max three movies out a year. But can you do that when you're making three or four movies a year plus three or four TV shows?
Spread the peanut butter too thin.
Yeah, too much bread, not enough peanut butter. So, you know.
Silicon Valley reference from the Yahoo days.
Yeah,
but so because Feige is the consistent thing, right? Because you were mentioning, well, they, you know, they moved to the second tier of actors. But a lot of those movies that you were mentioning, that those act, you know, obviously Black Panther, the first Ant-Man, those were all super successful movies on their own.
Yes.
With again, characters that were not major characters, with people that you didn't associate. So it seemed like the plan was working just fine. Then it really is just the volume.
The volume and just, you know, like Wakanda Forever, there has a lot to go, you know, a lot going for it, but it's missing a key component that a lot of people responded to in the first Black Panther movie, namely Chadwick Boseman. It has been years and years and years, and we're about to get The Marvels, which is the next Brie Larson-led film, but it's been a long time since we watched Captain Marvel, you know? Ant-Man Quantumania, unfortunately, that's a movie that really was a tipping point with the fans at the beginning of this year, because, like, what happened with the Eternals? What happened with Shang-Chi? People are like, yeah, maybe not top tier, but I'm still hanging with Marvel. Thor, Love and Thunder, people were a little curious about. But when Quantumania came out at the beginning of the year, that felt like a real turning of the tide of people saying, are these movies good anymore? And then Guardians 3 comes out and a lot of people like it. So that's why I call it the wobble, because I don't think it's been just a steep decline downhill. I think it's been inconsistent, whereas before, however you felt about Marvel movies, you at least pretty much
they were all kind of working.
Yeah.
They were all kind of working. You know, you could debate whether it was great art or not, but people like them, fans like them.
Consistent, right?
And you know? And now some of them like have not worked critically. Right. Some of them have definitely not worked financially. So how much of this do you think is also just a natural, like, hey, there was a thing that a lot of us liked for a long time, but we're not frozen in amber. Things move on, tastes change, and maybe just our interest in Marvel characters as a society, as a whole, is we're just kind of tapped out. Is this something that you know, Bob Iger and Kevin Feige can figure out, or do you think that just maybe it runs its course?
I remember back in, I think it was 2018, I was talking to Jon Favreau about the Marvel phenomenon, about the criticisms that you were raising earlier about, you know, is Marvel ruining Hollywood? And he brought up the Westerns and how for decades in Hollywood, the Westerns were sort of the dominant genre and you couldn't throw a stone without hitting another Western. And, you know, he was like, superhero stories right now are the Westerns. And he was like, and that will end at some point. The reason I'm hesitant to call it the end is we've been hearing the term superhero fatigue, I would say, for 5 to 7 years, you know, like very early. It's like the term.
But a lot of it was like critics saying that and the audience is like, we're not fatigued at all.
We're in a different place entirely. I completely agree with you. But it reminds me of John Landgraf coining peak TV, and we're still peaking, right? So many years later, right? So, okay, there is a difference now between how the audience feels versus how the audience felt before, and that's very crucial. Your question is, can we turn this ship around? Plenty of people are like, do we want to turn the ship around? And I think a couple things need to happen. Firstly, I think they need to make less. As Bob Iger said, who brought all this content in here? Like, let's do less. So do less. Make it better, stronger, further, faster, but do less. And then also, the complaint that I hear a lot from casual Marvel fans is it now feels like there's too much homework. And the do less is part of that, a partial solution. But I think what they're heading towards, not to turn all your listeners to sleep and get super nerdy, but there's a comic book event called Secret Wars. And that's something that they're planning to do in the future. And that might wind up being a soft reset for the whole universe. So you don't need to feel like you have to watch all of the movies and all the TV shows in order to understand what the heck is going on.
It is funny. My producer, Jelani, is listening to this. You know, as new Marvel product comes out, and we're like, do we want to talk about this show or this movie? And sometimes I'll say, Jelani, is this, you're really into this. Is this important? And so there's something with Samuel Jackson that's on streaming now or ran
Secret
or run
Invasion.
On Disney Plus.
Yeah.
Secret Invasion goes, well, it's going to be connected to Secret. And I just clicked off. I'm like, I cannot believe that, like, it's fine if you want to have the plot, but, like, asking me to engage in it because there's going to be some payoff X number of years and a dozen movies down the road. Well, like, no, just tell me it's a good movie and then I'll watch it.
Here's the deal with Secret Invasion. I'm not saying you got to stay tuned because, or you have to watch everything so you can understand Secret Invasion. Mm-hmm. Secret Wars, which is what they're hoping in the future is going to be sort of their version mm-hmm. of Avengers Endgame. They're going to bring in a bunch of characters that those of us who have been here for a long time are very familiar with. So, you know, Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man or Hugh Jackman's Wolverine. There's going to be something that's going to feel familiar to mm-hmm. everyone at every level. And that's going to feel potentially worth tuning in for, more so than me promising you, Peter, that the storyline is going to be interesting. They're going to have some flashy lure for you in the cast. And then the hope is that fallout of that quote unquote event is a new Marvel that we can all come into fresh if we decide we want to, or mm-hmm. if the superhero era is over. What an incredible run. And that's why, I mean, not to get too nitty-gritty on the book title up front, but the book title, it was originally MCU, The Rise of Marvel Studios, and it was in early 2023 when the wobble felt more and more mm-hmm. inevitable that we changed it to The Reign of Marvel Studios, which is not the rise and fall of Marvel Studios, necessarily. I'm not ready to call it DOA, but it's like, This is a moment in time when Marvel has supremacy in Hollywood. Is it over? We're not sure, but it's certainly like you cannot deny that this was their reign, you know?
Oh, this is so helpful, so useful. Thank you. I'm not going to let you go without pivoting quickly into TV. You mentioned peak TV, so I've got two questions for you. What are you watching right now that's great that I should watch?
Do you watch Reservation Dogs?
No, I know I'm supposed to.
Okay. Does that sound like too much homework? I mean, Reservation Dogs is incredible. What We Do in the Shadows, the FX comedy.
Yes.
Speaking of John Landgraf and Peak TV, like I love what FX does. They've got a lot of great stuff on the horizon. There's a new season of Fargo coming. They're doing Shogun the following year. FX did not pay me to say any of this, even though they are owned by Disney. But I think keep an eye on FX.
I'm definitely on FX. What We Do in the Shadows, we're like midway through season three. I can't recommend it
enough. So good.
It's super great. It's a comedy, by the way. And then I'm wondering how you think both the, you know, we've solved the writer's strike, we meeting Hollywood. The actor strike is supposed to get solved relatively soon.
Yeah.
Those things are going to happen. To the writers and actors' credit, they're going to get paid more than they would have to make those. That means costs go up. And then concurrently, we're also, for other reasons, seem to have reached the end of peak TV era, that a lot of the companies that were funding this stuff saying, we're no longer going to make as much stuff. And mm-hmm. we're not going to flood our streaming platforms with this stuff. And we're going to make less and we're going to sort of parcel it out less. So as a TV consumer, do you imagine you're going to feel that pullback in a couple years? Right now, there's just a lot of stuff that has to get finished and is going to come out. But when do you think you'll feel it? And if so, when would that show up?
2025, I think. 2024 is going to be really interesting because we're going to feel a little stutter of the work stoppage that happened this year. So we're going to feel like a little stutter in content and then a flood of content.
Kind of like post-pandemic, right? This stuff was supposed to come out and now here it is.
So 2024 is going to be a very unusual year for content. And then I think 2025 is when we're going to start to see it ease back. And, you know, I am of two minds always about peak TV. And I, again, preferred it when there were just a few great things that we were all watching together. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, what peak TV and the flood of content the streaming wars has brought in is just a ton of voices that might not have had a show made otherwise. And so there's a part of me that's sad to see that era ending if that's what is happening. What I'm hopeful is that we'll take lessons from that time and ensure that in the future, as things start to contract, as I'm sure certain streaming services collapse into each other, are consumed by each other, because all of them are operating at a loss at this point, right? So, you know, if they try to get together a profitable model, that they keep in mind that speaking of Reservation Dogs, mm-hmm. What We Do in the Shadows, that a diversity of voices stays in the mix going forward.
You know? Yeah, related to that, Roy Price, who ran Amazon Studios when it first launched, had a New York Times op-ed a week or so ago and said, it's not just that they're going to make less shows. It's that the stuff that was kind of really provocative and interesting and also, by the way, appealed to a coastal audience and coastal tastemakers, you know, going all the way back to like early HBO originals and the Larry Sanders Show. You're going to see less of that because there's just going to be less tolerance for risk. So not only will you see fewer shows, but you're going to see more shows in the Yellowstone genre where like, you know, some people like, a lot of people like it, nothing right. wrong with it, but like, it's not really that, you know, it's not really going to blow your mind, and it's cowboy stories.
Yeah.
You've seen it before.
Yeah. I mean, I would push back on that, except I don't know what the future of HBO is under Zaslav. Mm-hmm. You know, like I know that Casey Bloys, of course, is someone that we can trust to continue to make really interesting programming, but I don't know what his new
yep.
restrictions are in the Zaslav era. That being said, you know, back before HBO Max or Max, whatever you ever want to call it, before the streaming platform, HBO was making far fewer. HBO was the like curated, we're only making three shows bangers max only. At a time, bangers only, you know, and those shows were pushing at the boundaries of content. So that, I mean, that's the ideal model, of course, bangers only model. Everyone else follow suit. Make only good, great stuff.
Why don't we just make hits?
Yeah, really? how about that? That can't be hard, right?
That's always my motto. Just do good stuff, Peter.
Right.
Joanna Robinson, you're the good stuff. Thank you for coming on.
You're the good stuff. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to our sponsors for bringing the show to you for free. That's $0. Still the same. Thanks to Travis and Jelani for editing the show, producing the show, and thanks to you guys for listening. We'll see you next week.